Welcome to Dear Lovejoy, and today is another special. Woo-hoo! Today, I'm going to be having a conversation with Mark Forsyth. Mark Forsyth is usually better known for his take on the English language. He likes to talk about that. He's come on Sunday Brunch a few times. But he's written a book called A Short History of Drunkenness. Mark, you enjoyed the conversation, didn't you?
That was so great. I loved that. That was because that was just that encapsulated the whole of sort of history, human history, just in a really interesting way, taking one little element out of it. And I hadn't seen your interview, and I was going, oh, I hope they talk about prohibition. I hope they talk, and you did. And I find that topic so fascinating.
Yeah, so he talks about ancient Greece, and he talks about Rome, and he talks about Egypt. He talks about old prohibition and say animals and alcohol.
Any podcast that features drunk monkeys has got to be brilliant. How great's that?
But what's fascinating, I think, about alcohol is the fact that it's been so important in human history. At the moment in this country, it's going through a bit of a bad phase, as in we love it for the wines and the cultured end of the market.
But that's what he was saying about it's fine when rich people do it, but when poor people do it, it's seen as an epidemic. And I completely agree with him.
I've always
said that.
It's very true, yeah.
But it was fantastic because I've actually, I've drunk in a speakeasy.
Have you?
Yeah.
There's a few in London now that pretend speakeasies.
Speakeasy. This was, we were visiting some friends in a place called Silver Lake in LA.
Uh-huh.
And they were renting a house built in the 1920s and built into it underground was a speakeasy. They were three or four guys. Imagine this, three or four guys in Silver Lake near Hollywood renting a property, and they had a huge garden, and downstairs he went through a little door and there was a fully fitted bar with a bar and seats and stuff. It was astonishing.
Nice play. I bet that improved the drink.
It was just so great because you'd get yourself a drink and then you go up and have a barbecue in the garden. It was absolutely incredible.
Well, let's find out more than A Short History of Drunkenness. Here's Mark Forsyth.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me to your kitchen.
With all guests, I like to buy them a present. And today, I think I've got you something quite exciting. You do drink.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much. I drink my fair share.
Well, because we're talking about your book, A Short History of Drunkenness later, I bought you some alcohol. I usually buy people some wine, but I thought I'd go for something a little bit more...
it's all beautifully wrapped up in red tissue.
Yeah, a little different. So, I don't really know what it is. It's called a London Cup.
London Cup.
What is Mark's in this? Mark's doing the sign of it's good. Now the man in the shop described it to me as a like a Pimsy type thing. And do you like Pimms? Do you like that?
I like Pimms, and Pimms is gin based.
Well, I looked because you've got a history of drunkenness. I looked it up, and this is the story. Punch proliferated in a city gone mad for gin. After British sailors returned to London from India, they brought with them the magical potion that it takes its name from the Hindi word punch, meaning five, and named for its five flavour components: spirit, sweet, dilution, citrus, spice, and bitter. Our Sipsmith London Cup is inspired by these punches of old and blends Earl Grey tea, lemon, verbena, is that how you say it? And borage, and with a selection of vermouth and bitters, and of course our classic London dry gin. So that's where it's at.
You know, in punch, by the way, because it's an Indian word, so the pun there is five, means five, and it's the same pun that you get in the Punjab, which is the land of five rivers.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. And the reason why you're good at all this sort of stuff is because you know your language, don't you? I've interviewed you a few times on Sunday Brunch, and you've always come on to talk about words. What is your job exactly?
I don't know what my job is. I avoid having a job by writing books instead. So I, I write books. I don't know.
Tell us what your previous books are.
So my first three books were all about history of the English language. First book was about etymology, where words come from, things like the origin of the word punch and Punjab and how that's related to the pen in Pentagon, which five sides, it's all the same thing. And the weird and amusing stories behind very familiar everyday words. And words we all know well, but you don't know the story behind them. So then my second book was called The Horologicon, and that was about words you don't know for very familiar things. Words which are in the dictionary somewhere but haven't been used in years. Things like ergophobia, the fear of going to work. Or gongoozling, which is the act of sitting by a canal, staring at the water and doing nothing.
Were they ever used?
Gongoozling. Weirdly enough, I wrote that book about words that are no longer used. Since then, I've discovered, talking to people who live on canal boats, that word is still up and running. In the houseboat community, gongoozling is a thing. They'll say, oh, look at that gongoozler, just staring at us.
I was looking up a word the other day, and I think it might be an American word, not a British word, but you would know, or an English word, say. Lola. Is that a word?
It's in a song. Several songs use that word.
Lola Palooza. How do you say that word?
Lola Palooza.
And I looked it up because it's obviously a music festival, and I thought, I wonder what that music festival is about. And I realised it's an old fashioned word, which means excitement, exceptional, something like that. What does it mean? I can't even remember. What does it mean? Do you know?
Lollapalooza. Yeah, fun excitement. I'm not quite sure. I'd need to have a look at.
Do words come? They have a lifespan, don't they? Some of these words. Words leave the English dictionary constantly and other words come in. Is that right?
Well, sort of. I mean, words die, they get lost sometimes. I mean, there's a beautiful old word, wamble cropped, meaning, say, if your stomach's wambling, that means you've got sort of indigestion.
Yeah.
If you're wamble cropped, that used to be a way of saying you had such bad indigestion you couldn't stand up. You're completely wamble cropped. Okay. Beautiful, beautiful word to say. And that's died out, for example. But there are other words which are, you know, still going strong, you know, hundreds, thousands of years later. And the dictionary, the full Oxford English Dictionary never removes a word.
Doesn't it?
No.
Why?
Because it's a record of how the English language has been used all the way back to the beginnings of English, back in the first millennium AD.
Do you like the evolution of the English language?
I love it, yeah. I love the way words change.
Do you like lol? Is that a word, actually? It's not really a word.
Yeah, lolling and roffling and, they're words now, yes. I mean, anything is a word so long as it gets used. I mean, all of our, you know, every word was new once.
Right.
And words change their meaning. New words get invented. Words disappear. You know, back in the 1960s, everything was fab, and now it's not. But
yeah, do we have more words in our language than any other language?
Yes, we do.
We do.
The Oxford English Dictionary contains more words than any other language dictionary.
So I suppose there's sometimes when you're in Spain or France and you're speaking the language and there's just not a word for it. You know, that's why they call it le dentist or something, is it? Or not? That's probably not a good example.
I think it's le dentiste. But
it's probably a French word to begin with, isn't it?
Zahnarzt. Well, words shift language. I mean, English is a great big language because we borrowed or stolen words from, you know, every language under the sun. You'd take, you know, anorak, that's an Eskimo word.
Yeah, I'm so useless for the English language, but my vocabulary is poor, Mark. I'm teaching my youngest to read at the moment. She's sort of getting there, but it's quite hard because with the English language, you get your rules of how to say words, and then a word comes up which completely breaks them constantly. It's so frustrating. And she goes, well, why is it that then when it's supposed to be that? And you're like, yeah, I don't actually know. But there's always a reason because they've come from another word. Is it? Or come from another country?
Yes, usually.
Yeah. All right. You've written a book on a short history of drunkenness. Why did you write the book?
Why? Because I'm interested. It's sort of the same reason I wrote the etymological. I'm interested in familiar things and how they've come to be like they are. Why do we drink, number one? Also, why do we drink? We all know the rules of drinking, roughly. You know, you drink in the evening. You drink maybe on a Friday night. You drink at New Year. You drink with people roughly your own age, usually. But is that all the way it's always been? Or has it been different? Why do we have these rules? Why, you know, a lot of them are kind of internalized to us. In Britain, for example, you know, you can't drink in the morning. That's just a kind of rule in Britain today. Or you start,
unless you work on the market.
Unless you are either in an airport where for some reason it's utterly fine to drink at 7 a.m. or at a cricket match. Those are basically the two places.
Or you work in a market.
Oh, yeah, work
through the night.
Yeah.
Then they have the pubs open up in the morning for them, don't they?
Yeah, I used to work night shifts, actually. It was as a proofreader, but I'd go afterwards. I'd go to Smithfield Market, and there was a pub there.
What was it like?
Oh, it was great. I used to get, you had fantastic fry-ups because it was Smithfield.
Yeah.
At sort of 5 a.m, and yeah, all the market traders there. And
were they drinking beer and stuff at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they'd been up for hours and hours. They were finishing their working day, essentially.
We discussed that airport thing on this show, actually, because I find it so intriguing that you'd want to get half cut to go on an airplane. I just think the worst place you want to be drunk is on an airplane. But everyone disagrees with me. Everyone thinks that you go to the airport, you have a few drinks, you get on your plane to go on holiday. I think there's nothing worse than being on a plane having a few drinks because you can't get any proper sleep or anything, especially long haul.
I don't know. One of the few things, I mean, another reason I wrote this book about drunkenness, it's a sort of way of answering the question, is I wanted to know what drunkenness is.
Right.
And I've been drunk loads of times in my life, but I couldn't really, if an alien came from another planet or somebody had never got drunk or seen people getting drunk and said, you know, so what is this thing you call drunkenness? I wouldn't be able to say, I wouldn't be able to define it. And one of the only things I'd be able to say about it is you're never bored when you're drunk. I'm serious. That's about all I can say. Other than that, you know, you can say a couple of physical things like your reactions are impaired, but that's not why I'm drinking. It's not why I just wanted to slow down my reactions ever so slightly.
How would you know you're never bored? I don't remember.
I don't remember bored.
That's the problem with Drew. I was out the other night.
Oh, you...
Yeah, I've got terrible memory now. And the older I've got, the worse memory it's been for what happened when I was drunk. And I was out the other day and I went for a pint and ended up having a few too many pints. And I woke up the next day and then the guy I was with came and had a little chat with me about something. And I had to pretend I remembered what the conversation's about as my brain was seriously going, oh God, what did we discuss?
Memories. Oddly enough, I've never had or almost never had the memory loss thing.
Really?
It just doesn't happen to me. I've had it on absinthe, which is dangerous. I steer clear of absinthe these days.
But isn't there two different types of it? Isn't there the one which you're allowed to drink and then there's the hardcore version? Or is it all the same?
Ooh, I'm not sure on that. I remember getting lost between... My friend lived opposite the tube station and I was drinking absinthe at his place. And I walked out and it's literally across the street and I got lost on the way to the tube station. But the only other time I've had proper memory loss drinking actually was the first time I ever gave a talk about this book, The History of Drunkenness. Right. I did it at a bookshop, and a friend of mine who owns a bookshop was going to interview me on stage, and he thought it'd be a really funny idea if I had a bottle of whiskey in my hand the whole way through, which I could sort of swig from. And I thought that'd be a funny idea. The problem is that I got kind of nervous. I get nervous on stage, and when I'm very nervous right now. And so I kind of, as a kind of nervous tick, I kept just swigging from the whiskey bottle.
Yeah.
And by the end of the interview, I'd finished it, a whole large full-size whiskey bottle. And I don't remember anything after that. Although apparently I was awake for the next 2 hours, apparently. And so it was the next morning. I was actually texting everyone I knew who was there saying, I'm really sorry if I did anything. I've no memory of last night. And they all texted back saying, no, you were really sweet. Apparently I just sat around smiling at people saying, you're my friend. I like you.
I've just thought of somewhere else you're allowed to drink in the morning. That's on Sunday brunch.
Oh,
I drink on Sunday brunch here every week. We have
Minute. I've been on Sunday brunch.
Yeah, you're not
three times and I've never been. Actually, I did. I got given alcohol on Sunday brunch.
Did
once.
You?
Yeah. And it was really good quality. It was after the interview, though.
But if you do the drinking in the future, what you want to do is get coloured liquid. That's what the pros use when they're out doing that. They don't actually drink the alcohol. On EastEnders, it's not actually alcohol they're drinking.
Really?
It's fake stuff, yeah.
I remember when I first got book published and I was on a chat show. On the radio, it was my first chat show. I was very nervous, and the other people on it were all kind of old hands on the chat show scene. And it was, we all had to arrive at kind of 10:30, I think it was. So we'd all had to set off from home before 10. And I said something along the lines of, I'm not sure about these morning things. I get nervous and I can't have a drink beforehand to calm my nerves. And they all looked at me like I was, not as if, you haven't had a drink?
Really?
Yeah. And I said, no, because, like, you know, I set off from home at 9:45. And they all looked at me like, you amateur.
Go on, describe the book then. We haven't really got into the detail of it. If it is, it's like a journey through time of alcohol, is it?
Yeah, so I wanted to stop in at different times and places in world history and see how drinking happened then. If you found yourself in the ancient city of Ur in 2000 BC and you wanted to get drunk, how did you go about it? Or what did you do in ancient Egypt? Or what was a Wild West saloon actually like? Or, you know, the medieval English tavern, which you see in, you know, a Robin Hood film. What's that really like that? And so each point I drop in on, and there are about, I can't remember, I did about 15 or 20 chapters, I wanted to see how they thought about drunkenness, how they made this weird anarchic thing fit into society, and then in as much detail as possible, when you got drunk, where you got drunk, who you got drunk with, what were you drinking out of, at what speed? Did you get flat out drunk, or did you get pleasantly, you know, merry, or were you falling over or vomiting? And to see in detail how you got drunk in, say, classical Athens.
Okay, we'll go through some of those in a minute, but we've got quite a bad relationship with alcohol in this country, haven't we? We're binge drinkers. We drink to excess, whether we like it or not. We look at our European cousins, and they don't do what we do. They can have a couple of glasses of wine and leave it at that. We have to have a couple of bottles.
Well, down the Mediterranean, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called, anthropologists call them wet cultures and dry cultures. In wet cultures, it's, you're fine and happy with alcohol. It's lovely. And you can drink in the mornings, you know, a little glass. You see Italian, you go into a cafe in Italy, you'll see people having a glass of wine in the morning. And you can drink all day and you never get drunk. And it's all fine. Dry cultures, so-called, are like us and Scandinavia. You don't drink on weekdays, you don't drink in the morning. You can only drink at particular little times, and then you get flat-out drunk.
Okay, and so we're a dry culture over here. I'm going to tell you a quick story before we go on. Steve McManaman playing for Real Madrid. I used to go and see him play sometimes. He told me, he said, some of the players at Real Madrid, they'll have at lunchtime, prior to playing in a Champions League match or a La Liga match, they'll have a small beer. The first time he saw it, he's like, what's going on? Because British culture is you have a small beer and then you'll have another small beer and then a large beer and then a large beer. There's not a chance that you're just going to have a small beer before you go and play football. He could not believe they were doing it.
I think I believe that one small drink can help with your reflexes and coordination as well, because it makes you less nervous and calms you down a bit. Yeah, it makes your action slightly more natural. And then the next drink after that, your reflexes go down and down and
well,
down.
Again, I'm out of my depth here, but I believe that snooker, darts, and those sort of pub games, they often would drink just to calm their nerves. And when they banned it from the actual TV show, they were having to apparently go out the back and drink before they went, or they would have their water bottles and in it they would have a clear spirit to keep their nerves going.
I once heard, I don't know if this is true, but in darts, because they used to hold the pint in their hand whilst they were throwing the darts, you remember that, and then the darts governing body decided that this was giving the sport a bad image, and so they banned holding the pints in the hand. And for the next year or so, the average scores actually all went down. People got worse at darts because the darts players, as I heard it, were so precise in their throwing that weight in the other hand was actually being taken into account, and so they were missing the triple 20 because they were...
Okay, how did we become... By the way, I wish I lived in a wet culture?
I live in a wet culture. My flat is a little wet culture in the middle of Britain.
But wet, what did you call it?
A wet culture.
I wish I believed in I lived in a wet culture, because the dry culture just drives me nuts that I have to go and drink to excess. But why did we become dry cultures and wet cultures? What was the evolution to that? Do you know?
It's hard to say, and it switches around. I mean, odd enough, if you just read Down and Out in Paris and London, George Orwell book,
yeah.
He talks about how, and this is in the 1930s, how in Paris, everyone's a binge drinker, and in London, nobody ever gets drunk. So, and that's not that long ago.
Right.
So these things can swap around and move. Sometimes, I mean, there's a bit actually when I was writing about the Aztecs, their drinking culture. And they seem to have had a very dry culture where you didn't drink for weeks of time, and then on the occasion religious festivals, you suddenly got flat out religiously drunk. And then the Spanish conquistadors arrive and with their wet culture, and they also destroy the old religious calendar. So now there's alcohol available all the time. And there's no calendar, there's no particular time. But the Aztecs, who'd been binge drinkers, therefore just started binge drinking all the time. And this caused massive problems of rampant alcoholism.
See, it's really funny talking to you about alcohol, because I feel uncomfortable being a TV presenter and someone in the media. Alcohol is bad at the moment. That we're in a part.
We have to tell people to drink less and never. Yes.
Well, we're in a drink of moderation is what I always have to say. But we're in a you know, it goes in cycles, as you say. And I think we're in a period of time where alcohol is bad again at the moment. And I understand why. There's addiction. There's a lot of stress on our A&E departments and everything else. And there's a lot of violence and fighting and a lot of bad stuff which happens with alcohol. But I imagine its roots are in something which was celebrated years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So we're at a weird stage now in our history where we think it's bad, but I imagine when it was first invented or we first came across it, it was thought of as unlocking Mother Nature's little secret key or something.
Loads of cultures have thought that alcohol is absolutely great and were very happy with it. Everyone's been wary of alcohol to some extent or another. And that's as I say, that was another thing I wanted to look at in the book, was how, because all societies want, all governments want order and peace and sobriety, whereas drunkenness is not about order and peace and sobriety, obviously. So how do you fit that in? There are lots of cultures which have just thought wine and beer were great. You have the wonderful goddess of wine, Ninkasi, say in ancient Ur. They loved their beer. They drank all day. It was very happy. There's nothing in their literature about alcohol being bad at all. Similarly, the Vikings. I mean, the Vikings were deranged binge drinkers. Their whole culture revolved around it. They thought alcohol was wonderful. Their chief god, Odin, just didn't even eat. And didn't drink beer, just drank wine all day, every day. That's the only thing Odin ever consumed was wine in Viking culture.
Do we know when people, humans, first started drinking alcohol?
Basically, before we were humans. All of the higher apes and most developed mammals will drink alcohol if they can get their hands on it. The question is, when did we start making it? Because alcohol occurs naturally. So just leave fruit to go off a bit, and it starts fermenting, and you get natural alcohol. There's an island off Costa Rica where there's one particular kind of tree and particular fruit which produces loads of alcohol, and the mantled howler monkeys who live there just eat this fruit constantly, and they consume the equivalent of sort of 3 bottles of wine a day if you're adjusting for body weight, and then they just lie around in the forest canopy utterly drunk. And then occasionally fall out and die. But
that's a weird thing, isn't it? Well, you start at the beginning of your book by discussing animals. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
Let's get onto this, because there's been tests on rats, haven't they? Giving them alcohol. What happens to rats?
So rats, if you give a rat colony a limitless supply of alcohol, initially, chaos, they all get drunk. But then they quickly calm down. It becomes very human in a weird sort
of
way.
So can I just take you back? Well, so if you give them, how does it come? Is it just pure alcohol they're drinking, or how do they make it?
Yes, I think, well, it's a dispenser which gives out alcohol in solution, so without much taste, but it's...
But they know the effect and they like it and go back.
Yes, they know the effect, they like it and they go back. And quickly they calm down into a little routine and they start drinking only 2 times in the day. They drink just before they feed, which scientists refer to as the aperitif. And they drink just before they go to sleep, which is known as the nightcap. And then every 4 or 5 days, you suddenly get a spike in alcohol consumption in the whole colony. So it seems that they all have little rat parties. And it all sounds rather lovely. But then there's a slightly sinister side, which is that in a rat colony, you have a social hierarchy. It's like, you know, dogs or whatever. And there is always, it's the low status males who always drink the most. And there's always in a rat colony, the dominant male who's known as the king rat. And the dominant male, the king rat, is always a teetotaler.
Why do they think this is? Because he has to make decisions for the...
We don't know why. I mean, the problem is you can't talk to rats. You can't second guess. I mean, there is an odd, a beautiful odd little one about fruit flies. Fruit flies consume alcohol because they're at the fruit and the fruit's going off. If a male fruit flies is sexually rejected by a female fruit fly, he dramatically ups his alcohol consumption. And we don't know why exactly, because you can't talk to a fruit fly. We don't even know if fruit flies are conscious or have any thoughts at all. But it seems they're drinking because they're brokenhearted.
Okay. I was just wondering if you said they eat before they drink before they eat. Does alcohol make you hungry?
Yes, it does. It sets off a little receptor in the brain, whose name I completely forget, which essentially makes the brain think it's starving so that you eat more.
That's hence why we always do the kebab thing or the the burger or whatever after we've been drinking. There was also some experiments on ants as well. You wrote I read in the book.
Yeah, it's a beautiful Victorian experiment. If you get ants drunk, this Victorian scientist used whiskey specifically. Then they pass out, and other ants from the colony. See them passed out, they will pick up their friend and from the same colony and take it back to the ant's nest. But they won't do that from ants from another colony and another ant's nest. They only look after their own.
Right.
So this weird little behavior. He was trying to work out how do ants know who's in their colony.
So do all animals get drunk then? Is it I'm not saying they do on purpose, but all animals are susceptible to alcohol then?
And it
tends that most animals enjoy the experience?
Yes, some of them get very bad hangovers. Charles Darwin wrote about how the best way to catch a baboon is to get them off, just leave out beer. They get drunk, pass out by the beer barrel, and then you... You find them with a hangover and just bag them up. They all like alcohol. I mean, some quite ridiculously. This time in the 1980s, a herd of 150 elephants broke into a distillery and drank it, and then got violent. Elephants tend to get violent when they're drunk. And if you think about one drunk, violent elephant, that would be one too many. Yeah. 150 of them. They went around, they ripped up this whole town. It's funny and we're all laughing and I'm laughing too, but they did kill, I think it was 7 people.
Wow. It's just interesting to the thought process that I want to say that if I wasn't a human, I'd taste alcohol and go, oh, that's not for me. But, you know, you're telling me if I'm an animal, I go, yeah, I want some more of that. That's, I suppose, is everyone trying to escape life? I look for a new...
There is energy in alcohol.
Right.
Yeah, you can process it. It contains nourishment.
Okay.
About 10% of the enzymes in your liver are there just to turn alcohol into energy.
You also say that you... believe that farming might have been invented due to alcohol.
Yeah.
What's the explanation behind that then?
So sometime around roughly 6,000 BC, we settled down. We'd been hunter-gatherers, and then we settled down to farm. That term is sedentary farming. And the question, why did we do that? And the obvious answer is, you know, to grow bread. But the problem is, if you try and live on bread alone, man literally cannot live on bread alone because there's no vitamins in it. So you get ill very quickly and you die. But we do get vitamins from eating meat. So when hunter-gatherers, well, they couldn't really have shifted from hunting animals to just farming bread. But beer does contain vitamins. It contains vitamin B, which is the one you really need. And so it's quite possible that we settled down and started making beer and then started making bread after that. There are a few other reasons for thinking this. First of all, beer is, constant through history is that water is often just dangerous to drink. And also, if you settle down, once you've settled down, form your farm, you now have to go for a poo somewhere. and that poo is going to get into the water system, which is going to contaminate all the water, which means the water is going to make you very ill as well, but not if it's turned into beer. Third thing, very important, beer actually contains more calories than bread. If you have a pile of barley and you want to get the most nourishment out of it possible, don't make bread, make beer. It's liquid bread, it contains more nourishment because essentially you're outsourcing the digestion slightly.
They always say years ago in the Victorian times and stuff, people used to drink beer, weak beer, but they used to drink beer because it was safer than water.
Yeah, throughout most of our history, we've drunk beer at breakfast because, you don't want to drink the water. I mean, if you just think of where...
But it was low alcohol, wasn't it? It wasn't like 5%.
No, most of it was about, it would be about 3%, so slightly lower than us, yeah. But the thing is, I actually experimented on this with myself. So you'll drink all day, and you often find records which seem at first sight, you go, wow, that's a lot of beer. So a medieval monk in Britain would have a ration of 1 gallon of beer per day. And you go, what, a whole gallon of beer? Yeah, they must have been permanently drunk. But that's, a gallon is 8 pints. And if you consume that, if you're awake for 16 hours in the day, that's a pint every 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that doesn't actually get you very drunk. I tried this as a quick experiment. It's easy. Buy 8 beers, drank one when I woke up, 2 hours later drank another. And I wasn't...
Did you feel terrible? That made me feel terrible. I'd always feel sleepy all through the day. And
no, I was fine. Didn't really notice it much.
Because alcohol seemed to be quite a religious drink, didn't it? Well, it's sort of... The monks have always been making beer. I assume they drink it as well. And then in some of the churches, you've got the wine.
Well, in loads of cultures, you have religious drinking. Drinking to where you're trying to get so drunk that you have some kind of vision of God. Which is...
Yeah.
So in ancient China, they would drink until they had a vision of the ancestral spirits, for example. In ancient Egypt... They were crazy, crazy binge drinkers.
Really?
Yeah. And they would have this thing, once a year, they had the Festival of Drunkenness, which we know quite a lot about and how it worked. And essentially, you get together at the Temple of Hathor, and then they would drink and drink and drink until they vomited. And that was important. And then you drank more until you vomited again, and then drank more till you vomited again, until... Eventually, everyone's just crazy drunk, at which point they all had sex. There was a great big orgy. This is quite well documented. At which point, and then late at night, very late at night, in the wee hours, they would pass out drunk in the temple. And then, whilst they were all asleep, the priests would wheel into the temple hall the great statue of the goddess Hathor, and they put it up in the middle of the hall, and then at dawn precisely they would start banging drums and tambourines and shouting and screaming and dancing and making a lot of noise, and everybody would wake up still completely drunk, and they would see the statue of the goddess with the dawn light on her face, and at that moment you were meant to have this perfect religious experience of the goddess Hathor and be at one with Hathor, and anything you asked Hathor at that moment she would grant to you. But you probably couldn't remember what you wanted to ask.
And you had to go and sleep off a hangover after that. I suppose alcohol, in its way through history, has helped with the things like orgies. It's probably a little bit of in the Roman times, I imagine they drunk quite a lot, did they?
Oh, yeah.
And I suppose that helped when they wanted to get involved in their orgies and things.
Probably, yes.
Probably. going back to the farming... beer became, bartering was big back in the old days. Beer became, or alcohol became quite a big, it became money, didn't it, at certain stages?
Yeah, well, to some extent, yes. I mean, another great advantage of beer over, or alcohol, generally speaking, over bread is it keeps for quite a while. I mean, depending on the kind of alcohol, but, a bottle of whiskey contains a bunch of calories and will keep for 100 years or more. And whereas bread goes rotten very quickly. So it's a very useful thing. It's something you can trade in. And some of the very earliest writing, one of the letters, writing essentially developed to make IOU statements for trading and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was one of the very earliest symbols was the symbol for beer.
So I suppose when it started, it was there was fruit wines and wine and ciders and things from fruit, and then you had your beer. When did actual hardcore spirits like whiskies and stuff? Does it all evolve at roughly the same time?
Roughly. So it's slightly complex, but I can take it you through it quite quickly. Ancient world, no spirits at all. About 1000 AD, somebody invents, probably, we get the chemists, probably North Africa, work out how to distill alcohol, but they're probably not getting drunk on it. It's just a chemical discovery they've made. You can make this little thing. Then you probably seems to start being used for medicine sometime in the medieval period, but only in very small doses. Because remember, it's still very hard to make, and you need the, you know, the lab equipment, which would only exist in maybe a monastery, you know, at a rich monastery. And then it's in the 17th century that suddenly the idea of getting drunk on spirits and mass producing and going, wow, we, you know, this isn't just an interesting thing scientifically. It's not just a medicine. You can get sloshed on this stuff. And that suddenly takes off in across Europe, which is where it really starts, in the 17th century, and with disastrous consequences in some cases.
Why? People led to the death from alcohol? Or?
Loads of people. I mean, so the big one that came in England was gin. Yeah. And that was the massive thing. There was a London gin craze in the early 18th century. Everybody suddenly got this new drink. Everybody wants a bit of it. It's great. It was untaxed for various complex reasons. But people would drink pints of it. Because if you come from the countryside, you've been drinking ale all your life, and you drank pints of ale. Now here's this new drink. Oh, give me a pint of that. And this gin, 18th century gin, was about twice the strength of our gin. And people would just drop down dead.
From one pint? From drinking one night sort of thing?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because
I was going to say, it's weird because you would assume that, because people's life expectancy wasn't long years ago, so I assume that you wouldn't be alive long enough to get liver disease and stuff like that. But if you're drinking vast quantities,
you can get it fast, really
quickly.
And there's a little story I heard, about early 18th century, edge of London. There's a farm boy has arrived on the edge of London, mm-hmm. and some Londoners, for a laugh, decide to bet him. They offer him some money for every pint of gin he can drink. So this is first contact with gin. He drank 3 pints and fell down dead on the spot. So that's how fast you can die of alcohol poisoning.
Jeez. How did you research all this book, by the way?
Lots
of reading up.
Awful lot of sitting around in the British Library. Everyone sort of assumes, whenever I've told my friends, you know, I've been writing a book about the history of drunkenness, they say, oh, that must be great fun to research down the pub, eh? In fact, no. Sitting in the British Library, reading accounts of the ancient Egyptian festival of drunkenness, or there were just a bunch of whole books on the 18th century gin craze. I read them all and then condensed them into a chapter.
How often does alcohol appear in history? It must just rear its ugly head constantly, doesn't it?
Pretty much every single society that's ever existed on Earth has had alcohol. And there are a couple that may not. No one's quite sure about Australian Aboriginals, but pretty much everywhere, alcohol or some other drug. So in North America, say, before the European colonists arrived, they preferred tobacco. But basically, alcohol always wins out as the drug of choice.
Okay, when did bars start existing then, over here in the UK or wherever?
In the world, you can find them in an ancient city of Ur, 2000 BC. I've got a chapter on what going to a bar there would have been like. It would actually have been relatively similar to now.
In what way?
As opposed to like the ancient Egyptian festival of drunkenness, which is crazy, and we'd all be there going, time to go. Yeah. Your bars were on the streets. You'd go in, they were almost always owned by women. There'd be a woman behind the bar. She would sell you a big jug of beer. Slight oddity, you drank it through straws, so you buy a big jug of beer for everyone, put your straws, sit around it, each guy with your straw. You'd sing songs, tell jokes. So the beer would be brewed on site, so every bar is a little micro brewery. They're slightly dodgy places to hang out. There would almost certainly be prostitutes just outside the door looking for trade. But we would recognize this kind of situation. Whereas if you went back to us, like you know, medieval English, old English tavern that you see in like your Robin Hood film in the time of good King Richard the Lionheart, and you know, they always go in, the Robin Hood and his merry men go into the village pub. That didn't exist. They didn't have bars. They didn't have pubs in England.
Oh, when did that time come?
14th century, basically. Right. People, but before that, people drank at home. Or they drank in the church sometimes, or they drank anywhere that there were no pubs.
Okay, so that was a later addition. You mentioned straws there. I'm going to ask you a question. You might have the answer. But what are the straws made of? I only say that because straws have become, you know, something that you're not allowed to have anymore, as you probably know, because of the plastics and stuff. And I was just thinking, oh, wonder what their straws were made of.
Reeds.
Reeds. Okay. So they got their reeds out, and then they were all sharing a beer or just one beer?
Yeah. So you have a big jug. I've got a picture of it in the book actually, if you want. Okay. Somewhere. But I'm not. That's going to work on a podcast.
No, I don't think it will. But I could maybe try and describe it, which would be quite interesting if I could describe
it. Yeah, it's in the Sumerian Bars chapter. Okay. Where are we?
Dum 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 dum.
Page 31.
I'm nearly there. Right.
Illustration from
I've got it right. So there's a big you know what it's like? It's like when those people what are those smoking things called where people sit outside
cafe hookah pipes.
Yeah, like it's like one of those. You've got two people sitting around, there's a big jug and jar in front of you, and then you've got straws coming out of it. So everyone's sharing a it's a bit like when you go to those bars, they do those huge cocktails now, don't they? Have you ever seen those? Fish bowls. For Mark saying they're called fish bowls. So everyone sticks a straw in. The problem with that is you never know whether you're getting enough. They go, the fish bowls are a great marketing thing because everyone goes, well, I need to get my fair share here. So everyone sucks a bit harder. And then the cocktail goes down quicker. Yeah.
Good thing for the straws with their ancient beer used to have loads of sediment in it, loads of stuff floating around. So the straw, the sediment all floats to the top. The straw goes into the middle so you can suck out the pure beer.
Okay. And what happened in the Wild West then? Interesting time. I liked it that we've got it all wrong, haven't we, in our films of what the world, what Wild West was like. It wasn't full of poor people, was it? And
No, the Wild West was very rich, as opposed to the coasts. That's why people went there. They didn't go there to lose money. They went because though it was very risky and rather wild, there was an awful lot of it. There was a lot of money to be made out west. That's why you went. And usually mining or something, or building railroads or trappers. And wherever people went with money, people would follow them to set up bars to try and take their money off them, basically.
So we've got the saloons wrong, though.
Yeah, some ways completely wrong, some ways completely right, oddly. I would say the most obvious wrong thing about Wild West Saloon is, you know, those bat wing doors they always have in every Western.
Love those.
Which, if you think about them, are completely pointless.
Yeah.
Would you have that? They don't hide anything. They don't keep you warm. They don't, and they didn't exist.
Because when you throw the guy out, it makes a better impact when you're throwing him out. You know, when the bad guys have got the good guy, the good guy's got the bad guy, and they throw them out and they roll in. That's what it's a good impact for.
Nope, didn't exist.
No,
sorry.
Well, they have just normal doors.
Normal doors. What you would have, obviously, because, you know, keeps the warmth in. I mean, just think how cold it gets in winter in America. Yeah. If you didn't have any doors, everyone would be sitting in there absolutely freezing to death. So I'm afraid they didn't exist.
But you said that during that time there was just tents, people setting up tents and things.
Very early. What would the classic development would be? You might somebody might find strike gold or something like that. You get loads of miners immediately coming out to try and find more gold. So now a town develops very quickly. The first guy to arrive with the bar would be a guy arriving just with a barrel or two of whiskey, and then just put up a tent. And these were called tent saloons, and you just sold the whiskey out of those barrels until the barrels were finished, at which point you went home. If you see what I mean. So they were very, very temporary structures.
I can't remember. It's a while ago since I read your book, but there was a time in America that alcohol became quite dangerous because they were trying to get it out there, and so they were mixing it with any old rubbish to get it out there. Is that around that time as
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Wild West, there are all sorts of recipes still surviving on how to fake whiskey. Essentially, I mean, I was noticed because you gave me this lovely Sipsmith gin mixed with
It's not
tea.
Fake, I promise you.
It's not fake, but mixing pure alcohol with tea was actually a way of faking whiskey. And then you add in some other stuff. A bit of creosote, I think, was in their recipe for whiskey. And all sulfuric acid goes in for something else. I mean, it gets really very dangerous. And there's a reason it was called Rotgut. It was bad stuff, but it would get you drunk.
Right, and that's what people were looking for at the end
of the
day.
That's what people were looking for. There was a lot more spirits than beer, because obviously spirits are easier to transport, or there's a lot more alcohol in a barrel of whiskey than there is in a barrel of beer, so that was the main one that came out.
Talk me through the most amazing time, I think, in history was Prohibition. Why did it happen?
Women. Basically. that really is a chance. There are a lot of myths about Prohibition. The main thing was there was an idea that grew more and more popular over the 19th century when there was an awful lot of drink being consumed in America. But the idea was that most men would get their paycheck at the end of the week and they'd take it to the saloon and they'd spend it all on whiskey. And they'd come back to their wife, drunk as hell, beat her up, beat up their children, and then obviously not give their wife and children any money, so their wife and children were starving, and then they'd go back to work and then spend it all again in the saloon. So this, to what extent this happened is very hard to say, because, you know, trying to get the records, but this is what people believed happened. And so it became the first feminist issue in American politics, because this is where women really come into the public sphere. They didn't have the vote yet, but they could start to campaign on this. So it's always the Women's Temperance League, etc., who are campaigning to close the saloons. And this is one of the really big things people don't appreciate about Prohibition, is Prohibition wasn't really anti-alcohol. The people going for it weren't anti-alcohol. They were against the saloon. And they were against a cycle of violence associated with the saloon. They didn't care about, you know, some guy sipping a glass of wine on a Thursday evening, if you see what I mean. They wanted to stamp out. I think the best analogy is, if you think about football hooliganism, the easiest way to stop football hooliganism would be to ban football.
Right.
You wouldn't then care about, you know, a couple of kids kicking a football around in the back garden. You'd care about the banning football. The purpose of that would be to stop, you know, the West Ham Millwall game and to stop the hooliganism associated. So that was the idea, to break this cycle of violence. And it was a big feminist issue.
So they didn't ban alcohol. They banned saloons.
So they banned alcohol in order to ban saloons.
Right.
But in fact, they didn't ban alcohol. They banned the sale of alcohol, which is slightly different. If you had any alcohol saved up, you could continue drinking it. That was perfectly legal. So, for example, Harvard University, they worked out that they had enough wine in their cellars to last for 30 years. So
they were all right.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were a professor at Harvard, you didn't notice Prohibition happening. So in some senses, very effective, because it did close down the saloons. And everyone went off to drink in speakeasies instead, which had a completely different social register. Was a different way of drinking. First of all, women were allowed in. And women, though they'd been legally allowed in saloons, a woman would always be too frightened to go into a saloon. But suddenly, with this new thing, the speakeasy, all the fashionable young girls went off to speakeasies to get drunk themselves. So it became a completely different culture of drinking, even though the speakeasy was technically
so
illegal.
Speakeasy was something which had, it looked like a chemist from the outside or something. And then when you went inside, it was a
speakeasy looked like anything. Right. A speakeasy was anywhere you could obtain alcohol. So often it was just somebody's house or their apartment. There's a weird little thing about culinary history here, actually. Italian food, Italian restaurants get popular in America because of Prohibition. Because a standard Italian thing to do was to open up your apartment to and sell alcohol out of it. Well, people could come to your apartment and pay for alcohol. And then they'd throw in some food with it. And that's how Italian food got popular in New York.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
How long did Prohibition last for?
So it lasts 13 years, I think. Well, it depends how you count it. There is the great repeal moment. But in fact, Prohibition came in quite slowly with a bunch of states banned alcohol individually, and then it's not until 1919 that you get.
Is it sort of states like Utah and stuff?
Exactly. Well, yes. Most of the Midwest states had. So most of the states had already banned alcohol before Prohibition came in. And then a lot of states retained their ban after Prohibition finished. So Louisiana, alcohol was still illegal up to 1966. I think it was.
That's Could amazing.
Be Oklahoma. I'm trying to remember all this.
Yeah, sorry. I'm asking you a lot of questions here. So the interesting stuff is the how did it actually... So it was an issue for women. How did men decide to vote on it to actually make it happen? What was the process? Do you know the process of it? Or
yeah.
It just became a...
There are a bunch of processes going on together. So first of all, it's a women's movement. Second, you get the men who are with the women and approve of it. And then you also get a bunch of people, which is odd. There's a large bit of the electorate called the drinking dries, people who were in favor of Prohibition even though they drank, because a lot of people thought when they were campaigning for Prohibition that it would just ban spirits and maybe strong wine. And it was actually a bit of a surprise after the... So the constitutional 19th Amendment, yes, gets brought in, and then they argue out the specifics of, so how far down are we banning? And it's in the only at that moment they realize, oh, we're going to ban beer as well, at which point a lot of people went, whoa, what? There's a big element is that it's the moment that women got the vote. Another big element is that the as the movement for campaigning for Prohibition had grown, obviously the drinks industry had been campaigning against the idea of Prohibition. And the drinks industry was mainly German immigrants. And all the beers had German names.
Right.
And so the anti-Prohibition movement thoroughly associated with Germany and Germans. And the Germans were very, very popular in America right up till the First World War.
Right.
At which point you have this PR disaster. Women are getting the vote, and Germans and the entire beer industry suddenly looks unpatriotic, etc.
It's really interesting how things happen like that. And yeah, there's lots of points in history where there's a sort of these come together, and then extreme things happen. Like that. Prohibition seems extreme now to me, anyway. So how did it end up becoming? How did they end up getting out of Prohibition in the end?
Well, in the end, the main thing was the economy was tanking. The Great Depression comes along.
It's about money, isn't it?
And so why are we going to have this situation, which means people can't work in breweries, can't spend money, can't be barmen? It's crazy. So they repealed it. Also, to some extent, it had worked. The saloons were all gone. That whole world of the Wild West had died.
Right.
Because Prohibition obviously didn't work in New York. And we always think about Prohibition in Chicago and New York, where the gangsters immediately took over. We don't think about Wyoming, etc., where you didn't have just a speakeasy down a dark alley because everybody knew everybody. Yeah. And so the alcohol consumption in America had decreased dramatically. There's a great myth that people drank more during Prohibition. It's complete nonsense.
Right.
Alcohol consumption had gone down, the saloons had gone, that whole pattern of violence had gone, the Wild West, the exciting Wild West, had turned into the very boring Midwest that we're familiar with now. Time to move on, and we need to get the economy going again.
Ah, so Mark, are you thinking what I'm thinking then? Are you basically saying we need to ban bars and restaurants from Britain for a while, and then we'll get rid of the binge culture? Is that what you're saying, Mark?
I don't think they'll get rid of the binge culture.
Is that what you're standing for?
I think what we need is a big recession so that everybody goes back to the pub.
I do think on alcohol we need to put the prices up and what's it called? AVB. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, AVB,
I think we need to bring that down, which is happening. It's becoming really fashionable. All the items on Sunday brunch at the moment is the AVB coming down because they went really strong.
Bring the prices up so that rich people can drink and poor people can't, because an absolute constant of the history of drunkenness, which goes from the earliest times right up to now, is that when rich people get drunk, that's fine. But when poor people get drunk, they're awful.
All
just
right.
Awful.
Point taken, and I'll have to have a rethink. But I do think it used to be quite expensive when I was a kid to drink. So I'd be lucky if I could afford three pints or two or three pints. Whereas I think now they do. Oh, I mean, I went to one place once and just for an hour, every drink was a pound. I mean, Christ, really? A
Where?
Pound. Swindon. Oh. And it was like, how can this be a pound for a drink? This is ludicrous. Yeah,
that's incredible.
It's really hard to stay sober. This was a few years back, mine.
I was drinking in the House of Commons.
I had a drink there. It's weird,
isn't it? Strangest, but it's weird how cheap it is. Yeah. It's a classic example of what I'm saying. Drinking is fine when we do it, not when you do it. What? I went and bought a round for... Apparently you aren't meant to do it, I'll discover later. I went and bought a round for sort of four people, and I took out... I handed over a tenner, and they... He's counting out the change. He gives me a fiver back and then some coins. I'm like,
what? Yeah.
Damn!
I generally thought when I was in there that, and it might just be me being seeing what I wanted to see, but I generally thought the left were drinking beer and ales, and the right were drinking white wine. But that, you know, that's maybe just what I wanted to see when I was in there. It was a lovely hot summer's day, and I had a nice drink. And
I go out on that lovely terrace.
Yeah,
by the
and I enjoyed speaking to people, and they were all coming up to me and going, "You're one of us, aren't you, Tim?" And I'm going, "Absolutely not. I'm not one of any of you. I'm just." But they all did it. Both sides came up to me and the middle and said, "You know, you're with us. You're with us, aren't you?" And I was like, "No." But I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It was really interesting meeting politicians in their own world, MPs. Right. Was there ever a time in Britain we were going to? Why did we? We sort of banned alcohol, didn't we? We sort of have to read ridiculous licensing laws, didn't we? For years, have we ever tried to literally ban it at all over here?
No, we've never had the movement for a full-on ban in Britain.
No,
and I don't think we ever could really.
We had strange licensing laws, though, didn't we? When I was growing up, when we were growing up, these stupid Sunday.
Odd enough, I was working in a pub do you remember when they made Sunday afternoon drinking legal? Because when I was a child, Sunday afternoon drinking, the pubs all had to close between whatever it was, 2 and
people used
5.
To go out and then queue up waiting to get back into them.
And then so it must ludicrous. Have been, it was when I was 18, my first job, so it must be about 95, 96. I was working in a pub and on the first legal Sunday, and loads of people came in to celebrate. And I was thinking, I don't know any of you. You don't come in here normally.
Yeah, that's
but,
it.
Yeah.
And then they had later licensing laws at one stage. We had to buy food. Do you remember that? There was like, you could stay open later, but you had to buy food. So everywhere you went, they'd serve you sort of like, I don't know, some olives or something, some bread and some olives. It had to be hot food or something. I can't really remember it all, but there were some really strange rules. I just think the what did you call them? The wet
cultures.
They just had it better. Let everyone drink all day long, any day, and just not overdo it. All right, listen, we've got questions we ask everybody who comes on this show, so I'll ask them to you, Mark, as well. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Okay, I think this is related to writing, actually.
Okay.
So
That clears
up two of your questions on there at the same time. I know loads and loads of people who tell me I meet loads of people who say, oh, I want to be a writer. When I say I'm a writer, they say, oh, I want to be a writer. And they don't actually. Well, what they want to do is they want to be a writer. They don't want to write. They aren't interested in the process of writing. And
right.
Something I've noticed. All they have is an idea that being a writer is wonderful. And they think my life must be wonderful. And I must spend all my time sipping cocktails and swapping epigrams with other writers in exotic locations.
Yeah.
Which I don't. I spend my time writing. I spend my time wondering where to put a comma, where to put a semicolon. I spend my time thinking about what word to use in this sentence. And I don't have any work colleagues. It's a very, very lonely job. And just sit on your own all day writing. And people don't want to be writers. And they don't want to do the writing. And the advice I want to give is whatever job you decide to do in the world is about doing that job. You should never become a chef just because you like eating. You should become a chef because you like cooking things, because you like chopping things up, because that's what you'll actually do all day.
Go on.
Yeah, this applies absolutely everywhere. Yeah. Don't do the job because you like the outcome or like the product or like the thing associated with it. Do it because you enjoy that activity, because that activity is what you will be doing all day. Don't become a surgeon because you enjoy cutting people up. don't become a sculptor because you like sculpture.
Yeah.
Become a sculptor because you like chisels.
Do you enjoy writing?
Yes, I love it.
Do you?
I love it, but I'm a bit weird like that. I love grammar and syntax and all those boring things that everyone else, you know, didn't think about and tried to avoid at school. I loved them, so
that works for me. That's a good piece of advice. What mistake do people make? Is that the second question? Have you just answered that
one? Yeah, I think I kind of answered that.
Any life hacks?
Life hacks. Okay, I've got a couple. A drinking related one.
Go on.
The way to find the best pub is always to go down a dark alley. This is the extension of the rule. Like, when you're on holiday, never go to the restaurant or bar right next to the tourist attraction. Never go to the restaurant right by the Eiffel Tower, because it will be overpriced rubbish. But if a pub or a restaurant can survive when it's down a dark alley, that means all the locals must know it. It must be good enough to get the passing tradie and people actually learn where it is and bother going back. So always go there. Don't go to the one on the high street.
I went to where did I go to? Where's Elvis Presley from?
Memphis.
Yeah, sorry. I met a bit strange then. I went to Memphis and I said to I got in a cab with my friend and we said, take us to a bar, but where the locals go, not the tourists. So he took us to this bar, we went in there and there was a pool table. We had a beer and this guy came up and it was a really run-down bar. And I remember the bloke playing pool had a hook as a hand. And the other guy came
trying
up.
Trying to work out how that even works. Table. Yeah. The bees, you'll break the bees.
No, he was fine. But he had, it wasn't a sharp hook, like a pirate mark. It was like a... so he was playing and then this guy came up to me in the toilets. You know, all right. So he did American accent. I went, hi. And he went, you're English. And I went, yeah. And he said, what on earth are you doing here? Are you mad? I went back out with him. He goes, this is one of the roughest pubs in Memphis. And I was like, oh, really? And we got on really well with him because we were from Britain. And I think they could tell I didn't have any money. Yeah. So they were absolutely fine. But your rule's great, apart from if you end up in the wrong bar.
Yeah.
So, yeah, be careful. What was the other one you had? You said you had two life hacks, did you?
Oh, the other one is have a travel drawer. Have everything you need for traveling in one drawer, like your passport or your foreign currency, sponge bag, already packed, phone charger, always have the phone charger, everything you need, in one drawer. I've got one drawer, so whenever I'm going away, take out that one drawer, go through it, everything I need is there,
I have a travel man bag, very similar. Right, Jason Fleming, actor and director, top man, started something in this podcast. Michael Caine came on, he started talking about Michael Caine, told us a story, and we thought we would ask a lot of our guests whether they had a Michael Caine story. It doesn't matter if you don't, but do you have a Michael Caine story?
I do not have a Michael Caine.
You never met? Have you not met Michael Caine?
I've not met Michael Caine. Okay. I remember meeting Michael Caine. I've got a Michael Caine story. It's a story about Michael Caine. I've not met him, but I saw him telling this story once on a documentary. first film audition he ever went to. He walked in the door, and they said next, and he said, "But you haven't seen me act yet." And they said, "You see that line on the door frame behind you?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "That's the height of the leading man. And there's not going to be anybody in this film taller than that height." And that's how they tend to do things in films. And that's why you have the leading man is always the tallest guy, even if it's a very short actor. And you start realizing you see films in a slightly different way.
Very good. What is it like? Final question for you. What is the meaning of life, Mark?
Life... I have a feeling that in the Oxford English Dictionary, memory here, is it life or love? Life, the first definition they have is that it's a kind of rafter in a medieval barn or something like that. And then the second definition is, you know, the quality of living. I don't know what the meaning of life is. 41, 43, somewhere around there.
All right, Mark, if people want to get in contact, what's your next book, by the way? Have you decided yet?
No idea at all.
Okay, just going back to your first point, actually, the piece of advice. How long does a book take to write on average? Because it is a commitment, isn't it?
It depends. There's a difference between the writing and the research. I mean, for me, when I'm doing nonfiction, I've got to research it all and then do the writing.
Right.
The writing can actually be done in a few months, or
but the research
quicker,
can take
but the research can take I mean, they're searched. It's as long as you like, but it can be a lifetime, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So, if people want to follow you, where do they go?
Oh, Inky Fool on Twitter, or yes, there's a Facebook page also called Inky Fool, I believe, or there's my blog called Inky Fool.
Yeah, you do a blog, don't you? What's on your blog?
It's usually about language and, yeah, funny little stories about that. Actually, I was going to write, I was wondering, I went around to see a friend yesterday, 2 days ago, and they've got a new little baby and the midwife was coming around. I was thinking, why are they called midwives? And I have no idea. I must look this up. I was going to write, that's going to be my next blog post. Is it that you have a northern wife and a southern wife and a midwife, or a good wife and a bad wife and a midwife? I'm just interested. So,
so every time you hear language, you get interested as to where it comes from.
Yeah, you suddenly pick up on a word and go, wait, why? Where's that?
And does it intrigue you with modern language as well as old-fashioned language? Oldie days language?
Yeah, modern language can be just as interesting and weird.
Okay.
Why do computers boot up, all that sort of
thing?
Oh,
why do they?
It's from bootstraps, the idea of pulling yourself up by your bootstrap.
Ah.
And that became when computers first managed to start themselves in the 1960s. This was it was referred to as the computer bootstrapping. And then that got shortened down to the computer booting up.
I think when words change their meanings, it's quite interesting as well. Or they extend their meanings, like the video is used now for everything, isn't it? So if you send someone a film, you're sometimes sending them a video, or let's have a look at that video. And in TV, we use VT, which stands for videotape, run VT. And there's no video involved in it at all anymore.
Yeah, but when it was video, you were still calling it footage, and we still call it footage.
Yeah.
Now, footage refers to a length of film. It's how many feet of film. Like 6 feet.
Yeah.
How long is the film? It's so many feet. That's your footage.
I wonder where podcast comes from. Do you have any idea? Anyone have any idea?
It's an alteration broadcast, I think, along with the iPod.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. On that note, Mark, thank you so much. Your book is out now, A Short History of Drunkenness. Thank you very much for coming on. Hopefully I'll see you soon with your next book.
Great. Yeah. See you soon. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. So that was Mark Forsyth, his book, A Short History of Drunkenness. It's fascinating stuff. I still think it's fascinating that there was a certain stage that America managed to get rid of alcohol for a while. I mean, that is
astonishing. Yeah. There's a couple of really great films, if you're interested. One is called...
What? About Prohibition?
About the Prohibition era and what he was talking about. You know, we always talk about the New York or the big city stuff.
Yeah.
So there's one called Once Upon a Time in America. Have you seen that?
Yes.
De Niro film.
Yeah.
So, really long.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Can't remember, but I remember thinking it was
fantastic.
Good,
and another one has got Tom Hardy in it, and it's called Lawless, and that's the outback in the countryside where they're making moonshine, and it's quite violent, but it's very, very good.
I think I've seen it. I can't remember.
Good. And the other one, of course, it's not a film; it's a TV show, but Boardwalk Empire. Oh man, that's
not
good.
Seen that.
If they've got that, I think you've got Sky Q, haven't you, or something like that?
Yeah,
I think they've probably got that on there.
Sky Atlantic or something.
Brilliant. It's your man in it. What's his name? I don't know. Can't remember. But anyway, really very good. So check those out if you're interested in Prohibition. Really
cool.
Good.
All right. Well, listen, that's it for today. We'll be back soon with another Dear Lovejoy podcast. If you want to contact us, you can by on Twitter at Tim Lovejoy, on email dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to us. You can rate us 5 stars, please. You can leave comments anywhere. And we'll be back very soon. So for the time being, peace and love, joy.
Drunk monkeys. Bye.